Dr. Rock's radio show. Every Thursday night at 9 on raconteursnews.com. We go to 11.
I couldn't resist kicking off there with the little melee of John Lennon talking about the insanity of it all and David Allen's Death of Rock, followed by just a little bit of Hawkins. If you want to get into it, you've got to get out of it. After that excellent show from Andy and Jason and their guest about the state of modern music, and music as it has been for some time. Interestingly, I think I heard a whole talk at one Truth Juice gathering about the connection between military children, music of the 60s, and distribution of LSD from government sources. A lot of which was new to me at the time, but I've subsequently looked at it a bit, and it is pretty astonishing, isn't it? Like the man said, mind control isn't just done to individuals, it's done to whole populations. I still think the music's pretty damn good, though. After that, I probably played Dexter Dextrous and his Fingersmiths again, wasn't it? Yeah, it was. All Talk, quite an apposite song for tonight's show, because I want to talk a little bit about language. And now it's managed to move forward through time. And that one is all about that, of course. And then we had Turn It Up from Ted Nugent off Free For All, proving that rock music certainly wasn't dead when he was around. And I don't think it is yet. As I was saying in the chat box, the small festivals are really great places to go and find people of all ages, but mostly young people, it has to be said, turning out really great tunes with really fantastic lyrics. And as far as I can tell, pretty much independent of the world management team. Although it seems to me all they need to do is turn out one really great stroppy album, and that's probably all you get to see. So many bands turn out really brilliant first albums, and then just turn out what seems, relatively speaking, to be pap. And perhaps that's why it's all turned out the way it has. So that was a great show. I enjoyed listening to that. Also, by curious coincidence, tonight's show I was hoping to have on a friend of mine who has very successfully run in his life using the return to sender and don't answer the door methods. A simple approach which appears to be working very effectively for him and has done for quite a long time. So I'm looking forward to talking to him. But something he's realised in more recent years is that the kind of influence, the kind of occult influence that's being relied on by the world management team to do what they're doing is, as has just been said, relevant to us as well, that it is our intent and the way we use it that is going to make a difference, that actually taking the whole thing apart brick by brick would be really difficult, and that basically I think it's got to be replaced by us realising how much power consciousness has got to change things. And my RTS friend is also, as I said, into the beneficial side of the occult, because it is simply using energy. Energy is a tool, and it can be used for good or bad. One of our main failures appears to be that we haven't been able to get ourselves together to use it for good. I seriously think that is about to happen, and is happening actually right now. One of the pieces of magic that would certainly help is if we were to simply recognise the extent of the illusion around us. And I know that the people who are listening to Raconteurs News, and many of the people I now meet, are, it doesn't really matter how much of the illusion you actually spot, there's still more of it round the corner, there's still a bit more tomorrow. And if it is all to a great extent an illusion, then the amount of work needed to undo it will be relatively small, I suspect, in the long run, although things do look, I must admit, pretty damn fierce sometimes. And I think, as well as approaching our consciousness differently and seeking to unravel the illusion, the massive illusion that is being cast around us, one of the other key things is going to be working together. And it's coming up to that time of year again. It's been quiet, the dark months and the wet months, and been a bit weakened of late. But now the sun has come out again and the festival season is once more upon us. And nowadays, as most regular listeners will know, Rather than pay to go to big festivals, I actually go and crew at small festivals, and I try to do, I don't know, 3, 4, or 5 in a summer. And I do that because it's a great way of getting into a festival. And I discovered some time ago, that to be part of the festival and to be actually working in it and to be, part of the team that actually creates the whole thing and then makes sure it runs properly and that everybody is happy and has a good time and then tidy it all up again afterwards is a whole lot more fun. It really is a whole lot more fun than just handing over the meaningless promissory tokens to go in and spend more tokens buying more beer and all of that. It's a great way of kind of integrating oneself into what's going on. And it means that doing that sort of thing, I actually get to live and work with people and see, actually produce stuff. You know, it is, most of them are done for no profit at all. As far as I can tell, the ones that I go to, they're done for the love of it. And there's quite often 50 or 100 people involved in putting it together. And one way or the other, it's a show must go on situation where, you know, everybody's bought the tickets, you've got the field, you've got all the gear there. And one way or the other, it has to be made to happen. And then it's got to be tidied up afterwards. And of course, loads of things happen. If you've got 1600 or 2000 people in a field that you really, really can't predict. And it's all down to the versatility and creativity of the team really as to how well it all works. And I get my first trip out to Landed, actually. Dexter Dextrous and his Fingersmiths were a band that I saw there. It's a bit of a lig for me, that one is. It's a kind of, for me, it's a bit like a local party, really, because it's very close to where we mostly hang out, and I don't have to do actually any work at that one. I can just go and enjoy the bands and try and scrounge CDs off them, so I'm looking forward to that, although we'll probably only make it for a day or so. But coming up very soon is the Fire in the Mountain Festival, where Synchro and I are kind of the main focal point for organising a festival forum. That's much more, lots of work in advance of the thing. Obviously, you've got to get the tent together, got to get carpets, got to find content to go in there, and all of that, and then generally try and orchestrate the thing when it happens. And this is my first time really working as part of the core crew for the Fire in the Mountain Festival, and I must say, it has been a real pleasure. It's a complicated business. There's about 50-odd people, I think, in the core crew. It's a bit different every year and kind of grows a bit and has more infrastructure and the like. It's more or less entirely non-commercial in the sense that everything that happens there, the bars, the food, whatever, are practically all run by people who have been crew at the festival for quite some time. And this makes it quite a complicated thing, I suspect, to organise. But it's all being done, as I mentioned, I think sort of 2 or 3 weeks back, using principles of really seriously open management. So these guys have actually published the entire festival budget on their website so that anybody who's got any queries as to how much it's costing to come along can actually go and see where the money's being spent. We actively encourage people who come along to the festival to get involved with the ideas and to be part of it. And there is no power structure as such. Obviously, when you first approach organising something fairly complex like a forum, there's all manner of things that come up, like people who you need as a presenter telling you that they've got a couple of offspring that need to come in, and, you know, we've only got so many guest tickets we can give out, and lots of complex stuff, all of which needs to be sorted out. And my experience over the last 3 or 4 weeks whilst I've been working on this project is that the team is incredibly versatile, and one way or the other, there isn't any need for a power structure because there's good communication and there's good information. And this was always my feeling about Fire in the Mountain from the first year we went about 3 or 4 years ago, was that it was a very comfortable place to be and that things came together really quite easily and with a lot less stress than I've seen in other places, some festivals, but mostly places outside festivals. And now I can see why that's the case. It's completely excellent. Looking forward to be back on the road again. Probably doing a bit of talks about consent, I should imagine, this year. I think it's about time to start trying to get some of this information into what are basically straighter places. So next week I'm going to have my mate Mick on talking about Return to Sender, about the occult, and not Hunter in the Door. But this week I want to talk a bit about something else that I get up to on a regular basis, because it's to do with language, it's to do with people working together to create something unique and transient, you know, you put all the work in and then it's all over and you don't do it again. And it's something I've been doing for 10 years or so. We have a living willow theatre in Mid Wales that we planted, I think it is 10 years ago. This is its 10th year. It will seat 100 or so people, and it's on an organic farm, as I say, in Mid Wales, where we do a fair bit of other stuff. And there we have, as well as the theatre, we have, I guess, a community theatre company of about 30 or 40 people, all of whom are volunteers, all of whom put all of the time necessary in to make the thing come off. So we've actually got wardrobe and a couple of people in there, and we have stage managers, we've got people who do the electrics, all of which is run off solar and wind for the theatre. We have an indoor theatre, which is basically a converted barn, where we managed to score all the seats from a local cinema when it was revamping itself. So that's a comfortable place, but it doesn't hold as many people as the open-air theatre does, unfortunately. And what we do in April is we have a bit of a read-through of a Shakespeare play, because that's what we do. There was a charity there based all around Shakespeare. And we have a read-through, and then 5 or 6 weeks later, we'll actually be on the stage doing the show for 2 or 3 nights, generally, to start with. And I just really love the process. I love the fact that nobody understands really the first thing about it when you first read it through. I really love seeing people gathering an understanding and a comprehension of what it all means and what it's supposed to be expressing. And then making it so that an audience is going to find it in some bizarre way real. Because, frankly, Shakespeare's plots, with one or two honourable exceptions, are actually pretty crap. It's very difficult to imagine, actually, how you can sit there and be drawn in. This is another aspect I really like about it, is that when you're on the stage looking at the audience, you can tell whether that's happening to them or not. And at the Willow Theatre, it normally does, because we're lucky enough to have extremely able and experienced people working with us, which makes for a very tidy product. And the fact that people can look at such a bizarre story and actually be drawn in for the, 2 hours and a little bit, and you can see that it sort of changed them on the way out, and they're kind of thrilled by the whole thing. But like I say, the actual plots are well dodgy. And it is, I think it's a really great thing to be doing for as long as I can remember, right the way back to my earliest school days. I remember being on a stage. Perhaps that's why I kind of developed this idea that I quite like to platform. And for all of my education, I did loads of it. And then I took a while out and got drawn back in, I should think, 10 or 12 years ago, when I was fished out of a manure pile to go and play a druid in a local theatre. And that reminded me how much I really, really liked it. But also, I think for me, it's really great to go out and pretend to be somebody else. It used to be just kind of for fun, but now I realise that due to the structures that we have around us, it's pretty much what's happening when I go out into the real corporate world, when I'm out in federated space, that there's a lot of demands on you that make you pretend to be something that you're not and impose all sorts of obligations and requirements upon one that are somehow mistaken. Now, by being on a stage and pretending to be somebody else and working with a load of other people who are also pretending to be somebody else, I think that it makes it easier to understand the mechanics of what's going on in the wider world. And one of the things that's really struck me over the last 2 or 3 years, and I think it's that long since I visited this subject on the radio, I've been given 2 or 3 very interesting parts. I tend to get the rogue who speaks the truth to power and things like that. But I've realised that Shakespeare, whoever he was, and I'm with everybody else, I suspect here, not at all convinced that he was an actual individual. Through the history of literature, there have been people around who have been, if you like, a lens through which the work of many others is projected and pulled together. And I can sort of see how that might happen with Shakespeare, because when you look at it, you can actually see, quite often you can see the program running. I mean, these works have been performed all over the world, you know, in Japanese and African, everywhere. And they still are, more or less every year. There have been formed on Royal Naval ships and everywhere, everywhere, all over the place. And they are still being performed 400 bloody years down the line, even though we've got much better special effects and much better plot lines nowadays. And I think you have to ask yourself why that's happening. Really do, because there's absolutely nobody else from that time that is being performed that regularly. There's one or two particularly good gory ones, like the Duchess of Malfi and the Revenge's Tragedy and stuff, that occasionally get to visit a stage. But looking around and working the way we do with the subject, the Bard of Avon is just unfeasibly popular, really. And he couldn't... It's said that It's said they couldn't write about the English court because they'd get into all sorts of trouble if they did. And so the plays were habitually set in places like Bohemia and Sicilia, and they all had strange names and stuff, so that presumably the groundlings didn't make any connection between the absolutely execrable behaviour of the nobs and royalty in Shakespeare and the people that were actually governing them. Lees put in, Sir Francis Bacon seems to be Shakespeare's analogue. Yeah, I suspect a committee, Lee. That's one of the interesting things I think about Shakespeare's work, is the poetry in it. It's not all in poetry. I think it's about 60% of it is in this thing called iambic pentameter, which goes de-dum, 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 de-dum. Those are the stresses. And he always put the stress on, tended always to put the stress on the verb rather than on the I or the you or the me. So he was interested in the interaction between subjects and objects rather than in the subjects and objects themselves. And by writing like that, he ensured that people could simply be given scripts and deliver it with the correct sense. Quite an interesting stress to have been making in the 17th century, when the language as we know it today was just getting established. This is when they were standardizing spelling and all that kind of stuff. Now, the thing about the poetry is that it's said, and I haven't counted, but I'm sure you could find an algorithm that would, it's said that of the lines that are written in poetry, some 98% of them are perfect, i.e. the stress is evenly distributed and they've got the right number of syllables. But it's been pointed out that even the 2% that are not perfect, that are either missing a syllable or have an extra one, which has a tendency to make the line lurch a little bit, the characters that are delivering those lines are under stress of one sort or another, as people, it has to be said, frequently are in Shakespeare. And so you could actually validate the slight, even those imperfections in the poetry. Now, I think it would have taken a hell of a lot of work for one man to do all of that. I suspect it must at least have been tidied up by some. And it does have to be said that round here, obviously, or at the Willow Theatre, Shakespeare was a man, an actual literal man, but also at Penland only Jesus was a real man, historical man as well. These ideas don't go down too well there, but it seems to me that there isn't a lot of evidence, but we do still have the texts. I think the going onto the stage for me is really therapeutic as well, because you can't do it half and half. You really can't go on there and not concentrate, because you're not going to remember your lines. You need to be paying attention to what other people are saying. And even when you've got no lines, you've got to be being there. The audience will be looking at people who aren't actually talking, and it's necessary to sort of create the illusion and then sustain it. And all of that effort means you can actually go in there with a whole lot of stuff whizzing around in your head and all the rest of it. But by the time you've finished your rehearsal, you're kind of a different person. It's a bit like taking a break from what I would have called reality, but I suppose now it's like taking a break in a play from a play. So for me, it's actually doing it is a source of renewal, just doing the rehearsals and getting to work with people that closely. But especially so once you get it in front of an audience, because there really is a kind of feedback loop between what's going on the stage and what's going on in the audience. It's as much true of going out and doing public talks as it is of going out and trying to remember a load of lines and deliver them in the right points and all of that. But doing it as the public talks work the same way. When I write a talk, I can work really hard on it and think I know what it is that I'm talking about. When I actually take it out and give it and put it in front of an audience, you can feel which bits they're interested in and which bits they're not. And it's not really until that actually happens. It's not really until the whole thing finds its way in front of some sort of feedback loop that you can tell just exactly what it is that you're talking about, which is a bit bizarre, but it's definitely true of doing one of these productions where you are trying to cast an illusion. Actually getting out there on the first night and doing it on the stage is loads of fun. It's almost as much fun being in the bar afterwards, but actually getting on the stage and doing the thing is just such a crack. Mithrin said, do you stay in character all week? I do my best not to, actually, because most of the characters I play are complete nutters who speak words that are really difficult to understand, which means that it's up to me to try and make the modern audience understand these various jokes and references. It drives me crazy staying in character all week. That's one of the great things about it, of course, is that you kind of pop in and out of it. Also, over time, you get to play lots of different sorts of things and imagine what it's like to be that character, because that's what you have to do if it's going to be acceptable, if it's going to be anything like realistic. So that's another interesting aspect of it, which I find is washing into the research and the radio work and all the rest of it, is that in order to make your bit of it work, you have to try and look at the text in front of you from lots of different points of view, try and find out how you're going to say it, where your stresses are going to be, how it relates to the other people on the stage. And it's a kind of form of analysis that I think I find myself doing far more often in the real world. I think it's kind of washing off a little bit, if you like, is that I find myself, as a result of this kind of experience, and perhaps being interviewed, doing interviews on the radio as well, listening much more carefully to people that are talking to me and trying to think a little bit about how I'm going to react to them. And there's a bit of a feedback loop going on in the work on the wooden stage and the work out on the stage of life, as it were. So being able to look at things with different points of view makes the performance a lot more convincing as well, because it is going to change depending on who it is that's playing the other parts. This is one of the very strange things about Shakespeare, and probably one of the factors that's made sure that it has been played for 400 years or so, is that there seem to be millions of different ways of doing it. No two productions are the same. Some of them are completely incomprehensible, and then you can go and see the same play and you'll be able to understand it totally, depending entirely on who's doing it and what they're trying to do it with. So working out what's being said and why you're saying it is really important. You know, you've seen the script, I've seen the script, you know, I've been messing around with it for 6 weeks or so, but you still, some thoughts are like in the character's head and they're there, they're domestic, if you were, and other thoughts are thoughts that are occurring to them as they're kind of going along. And all of these things, a new thought arising from immediate circumstance is going to look differently on the stage. And all of this defines the way in which the words are said and the delivery. And that's where the sense is. You know, the sense comes from the delivery. And I think one of the reasons it survived so long is that there are so many different ways of saying the same words, but actually squeezing a different meaning out of it. Which again, of course, is something that we're very used to with our alternative views as to the world around us. And it's not just working out how you're going to say what you're going to say and how you're going to move what you're actually going to do, but it's a matter of listening to the other characters and trying to understand how to respond to them, like I said, when you haven't got anything to say. If you're standing around on stage, which can happen for quite a long time, and you haven't got any lines, you've still got to be listening really carefully to what everybody else is saying and responding to them. And in my experience, this tends to be a matter that happens live rather than is rehearsed. So certain things, you know, you're going to walk from here to over there and then back again or whatever. But loads of other things are actually variable, and you could do even kind of nightly performances by the same theatre company can be quite different depending on where you are. And also sometimes we get to swap people. That's really good fun when you do 3 nights with a regular cast, and then when you go and do a bit of a tour, some people can't make it, so you have to have another individual entirely in some of the parts, and that completely changes things. I think it's brilliant. They're saying the same words. The replacement individual is saying the same words and making the same basic moves as the individual they're replacing, but it's completely different working with them. It's fantastic, really, because it kind of really brings into sharp relief the actual variety of the world in which we live, and just how important it is, the words that we choose, and how we choose to say them. One of the things I really like is watching people who haven't got any lines to say. There's some people who I call good face actors. They can, their faces can just sort of display loads of things. In a series, I remember watching the lady that we had playing Juliet once, and her dad was in the audience taking photos, and he took three photos on one of those quick takes where it takes a series of shots in fairly rapid time. And in four shots in a row, she had completely different expressions on her face. And even that talks to the audience. In fact, it's really one of the most effective ways of doing things, I think. The important thing is that it appears live. It's got to not appear rehearsed. And we have a group in every now and then who, called The Factory, who are really, really excellent. About the best thing I've ever seen on a stage. And what they did was they did a play called As You Like It, and they hadn't actually rehearsed together at all. Everybody had was given, like in Shakespeare's time, they were all given their cues and their own script, their own words, and that was it. So what you've got is a load of cues and a load of words, and The Factory on this occasion, they had the whole kind of theatre company sitting on one side of the theatre, and nobody knew in the company who was going to play what, and the play started and the first geezer stood up and he eventually delivered a cue to the second geezer who stood up. And only at that point did everybody else get to know who was playing that part. They hadn't rehearsed their entrances or their exits or anything like that. And that made it really live. And one of the things that was curious about that was it made it more convincing. Even though it was the same plot as I'd seen several times before, it was actually noticeably more engaging having it put across that way than having it put across by a well-rehearsed team, although really good rehearsed teams can make it look like they haven't actually practiced it at all. But I think that that takes a bit of a lifetime. And the other thing is that some of the things that you can learn, because you learn reactions because they're in the script that aren't actually reactions that one might have in real life, not your reactions, if you like, but they give you a chance to experiment with it and find out what it's like. And I have noticed that that such skills can actually be used pretty successfully in real life. I mean, one of the guys we've got with us is absolutely fabulous. You don't actually need to give him any lines at all. All you have to do is give him like a tea towel to hang over his arm and a couple of chairs and a table to move. And that's all he needs. He will get the biggest laugh of the show by doing that. If you want a pirate, he can just do it by changing the way he stands. The illusion that one individual just in his normal clothes with no props can actually create, even with no words, is quite astonishing. And I think, given the level of complexity and the amount of, oh, I don't know, lighting and digital manipulation and special effects and all that that we've got around us, it's really, I think, important and helpful to recognise just how effective even really simple illusions can be. And, like I say, it can be used in real life. I remember we had a bit of trouble with entrances and exits at the theatre when it was being set up. There was a bit of a cock-up on the planning, and the highways department liked to have something to do with all of this, and they set all sorts of really quite difficult and in some places absolutely unexecutable limits on what can be done. And we were having a bit of difficulty because of one thing and another. And it took 2 years for the highway department to actually turn up. And as I'm sure you can imagine, there was quite a lot of frustration at this. But nonetheless, when the 2 years were up and the highways man appeared at the door with his grey crew cut and steely blue eyes and grey jumper and knocked on the door. He was welcomed at the place like he was a long lost friend. You know, oh, thanks so much for coming and seeing us. Do pull up a chair. We've got a fire down here. And the whole thing was sorted out really, really easily. Of course, that was an assumed kind of response. There had been a lot of grief. Made a life really, really difficult for himself there, but chose not to, and everything sorted itself out. So some of the acting competencies that are developed on the stage, and the man who pulled that particular stunt is a professional. He's been doing it for a long, long time, and it's great. It's great to watch different parts of him engaging with different people. But really, interesting process, quite apart from what's in the text. And the text is one of the things I want to talk about next, just about, because rather like Shakespeare couldn't write about the local court, because it would have got him into trouble, apparently. I think there was a lot of other stuff he knew about. He knew that whoever this cabal was, or committee, or whatever it was, it knew a lot about shamanism. It knew a lot about the occult. It knew a lot about nature. And one of the things I've realized in the parts I've specifically been given in the last 2 or 3 years is that I suspect he also knew about the name. I think he knew about legalese. He certainly knew about the fact that when things are written down, they are an illusion, they are a fiction, but that they are a fiction that the masses believe to be fact. This is one of the interesting bits of the part I'm playing this year. But before I get into that and have a look, quick look at some of this stuff, because of course it would all have been being formed then, 17th century, you know, after the fire of London and all of that. This was when we went up the gearbox and all of this stuff started happening. Like I say, the standardization of the language, the invasion of the banks, probably the establishment of legalese through all of that. And it's interesting to see it, I think, kind of like, it's actually quite plain. Once, it's like everything else, isn't it? Once you know and understand something, once you've comprehended it, it kind of pops out all around you. But if you don't know about it, you don't see that it's there. So I want to talk a little bit about some of that, because I think it's great. I do. I think it's great that it's kind of concealed in there. And normally the lines that we might go, ooh, bang on, absolutely right, matey, they get a good laugh. Because all these people are clowns. They're important to unfurling the plot, but they're not what are called the responsibles. They're not the knobs, you know, they're not the kings and the queens and the princes that, and shepherds that make up so much of Shakespeare's stuff. They are actually the fools are the people who get the biggest laughs, which is great. That's why I like playing them so much. Mitherin's got a question in the chat box before I go to a tune. He's saying, so are you saying the guy has a library of formed characters in his head? Yes. Yes, I think that's probably a fair comment. I think one of the reasons why it's so unfailingly and everlastingly popular is because he is dealing with archetypes. He's dealing with types of people. And there are individuals in there. But I mean, when you look at Hamlet, you know, he's simply an angst-ridden git that couldn't get anything done. That's what it boils down to. And you get a whole five-act play out of that. And a lot of people die in the process. But that's basically what it is. And I mean, I do, when I'm in my cups in the bar, I have been known to say that they're all bastards and manipulatrixes and all the rest of it, because they are. So yeah, I think he did have a library of characters formed actually in his head, which I think he put to good use, basically. But it does have to be said that a lot of the language is really beautiful, and a lot of it is really, really expressive. I won't be quoting too much Shakespeare at you, you'll be glad to hear. There's just a few lines I wish to use for illustration. But I'm going to play 6 or 7 minutes of music, and next one is Let the Jury Sing from the Clown Factory EP by Mad Apple Circus, who I saw at the Landed Festival, I think about 3 years ago. They were grand. Here they are, back in 7 minutes or so. Horace X and a puppet show there, pulling on our strings like a puppet show. It's all distraction and illusory, telling us a fairy tale story. But actually, a lot of the fairy tales have got some truth in them, haven't they? Probably more than in the newspapers, anyway. So, this guy's, or these people's plots are, as I said, by and large, very poor. There's a lot of knobs, there's a lot of bastards, there's a lot of idiots, there's a lot of manipulators kind of abounding. But actually, when you think about what went on at the great going away of buildings and many, many other things, maybe Shakespeare's plots are not so utterly bizarre. I mean, my character actually gets to wear 3 false beards in the process of this play in order to disguise himself from the other characters. There's even one bit in which an angry father turns up in disguise to the place where his son, who's kind of run away, is. And the son doesn't recognize him. And this sort of recognition thing runs all the way through. Statues come alive and people get confused with other people and all that kind of stuff. But when I've been thinking about it recently, I've realized that, well, that's actually how it is. I mean, you know, the policemen are supposed to be peace officers. But when you look at what some policemen are doing all around the world and things, you can see that they're absolutely not. And they don't even have to put on one false beard, let alone three. The illusion is just completely entire and no less incredible really than the stuff Shakespeare was putting on the play, on the stage. But it kind of works. As Shakespeare works, the audience gets involved in live theatre, not just him, but obviously other people who do things that are worth seeing. It all works because of what the classical writers, I think, call willing suspension of disbelief. We're actually able somehow to choose to override our own tendency not to believe something that is completely bizarre or ridiculous. This seems to be built into us, and it's how theatre and, you know, obviously propaganda and TV and cinema and all the rest of them work. They work because there's some bit in us that can take this really bizarre stuff and actually swallow it enough for it to give us a, you know, really good bit of entertainment for 2 or 3 hours. And, of course, this is exactly what's happening every day. It's all a kind of tale. I mean, the character I got this year, he's a kind of fraudster and a pickpocket. And one of the things he sells is ballads. And he sells ballads to what are basically shearers. They're shepherds. So he's got these kind of ballads written down. And one of these kind of shepherd characters says, "Oh, let's buy some. I love a ballad in print, for then we are sure they are true." And I think that's really great. I mean, this character really plays with the shepherds. He does. He really takes the piss out of them. But "I love a ballad in print, for then we are sure they are true." And then this guy comes up with this ballad about a usurer's wife being brought to bed, you know, about to have a baby. And she gives birth to 20 money bags, and she longs to eat adder's heads and toad carbonadoed. And this, the shepherd says, "Is it true, think you?" And my guy, Autolycus, he says, "Very true, and but a month old. And look, here's the midwife's name on it. Why should I carry lies abroad?" I was just reading that, and I realised that if things are written down, people do seem to believe they're true. And I suppose the equivalent is on the news as well. And the contrary is also kind of true, that that when people don't see something written down, or if they don't see it on the telly, then it can't actually be true either. And he really pushes the point on that one by telling another ballad of a fish that appeared upon the coast on Wednesday, the 80th of April, 40,000 fathoms above the water, and sung a ballad against the hard hearts of maids. It was thought she was a woman and was turned into a cold fish for not exchanging flesh with one that loved her. And another of the shepherds go, "Is it true too, think you?" And it's just one of those examples of stuff where I'm looking at it and I'm thinking, it really is telling us how it is, because our modern day ballads are written in newspapers, and there does seem to be this belief that if it's written down, it is true. And all these shearers, all these shepherds, they get conned backwards and forwards all the way through. They get sold counterfeit stones, they get all manner of skullduggery pulled upon them, and they don't really notice. And it just strikes me as being very realistic. And in the end, the guy even uses a metaphor, what the allegory, whatever it is, to say that he's going to pull a trick that makes the shearers prove sheep, which is, of course, exactly what's happening to us, kind of day after day, every time we leave our dwellings. And there it is, in his print. And last year I played a guy called Master Constable Dogberry, who got more laughs than I've ever got before. And he was, as his name suggested, a constable. And actually, he was the kind of constable that we'd all like to have come across. He knew to let be. He's a bit like city watches everywhere, I guess. But there's a bit where the knobs, because they're too busy conspiring and stuff to actually do the job themselves, they put this bloke in charge of a court. And he says to these two geezers who've been kind of drug in, bound, as it were. And he says to one of them, he says, "What's your name, friend?" And the guy says, "Baraccio." And he says to the other guy, "Yours, Sarah." And this bloke says, "I am a gentleman, sir, and my name is Conrad." And the constable then says, "Sirs, it is proved already that you are little better than false knaves." Which I think is really brilliant, isn't it? They've basically been drug into court, and they're they're in chains or whatever. So they, and they're answering the questions in chains. So they're basically stuffed anyway. But all they have to do in this little scene is give the guy their names, and they are already, little better than false names. There it is again. Just a little, a little soupçon of stuff that is actually information, but appears just like a joke. Cause we know it is like that. Turn up in court, hand over your name, and you're done for, basically. Turn up, sign in, go down. And it's very understated. I mean, obviously, elsewhere in more famous speeches, he does actually get into the name, with Juliet saying to Romeo, deny thy father, refuse thy name. 'Tis but thy name that is my enemy. Thou art thyself, though not a Montague. What's a Montague? It is nor hand, nor foot, nor arm, nor face, nor any other part belonging to a man. What's in a name? Isn't that just the most important of questions? There it is. I really love it. Everything and nothing is in the name, I guess. It depends how you look at it. And Romeo would be, she says, were he not Romeo called, he'd still retain that dear perfection, which he owes without that title. Romeo, doff thy name, which is no part of thee. I have a suspicion that if I was still doing what I used to do at college, I could probably come up with quite a good essay on how many other places throughout Shakespeare this stuff is referenced. And we've noticed, haven't we, that it is important for the world management team to let us know what they're doing for some reason that I haven't seen really explained. I think it's an occult reason. We have to know what it is that's going on. And one of the reasons I think why I've had the idea over the years that Shakespeare is simply keeping the program running, that it's part of the education, part of the conditioning, is because there's all this stuff kind of concealed in it. And what I really like about it, I think most of all, is that the more you know, the more you find out, the more you can actually find in the text, which I guess, again, it's a sign of how the world manifests, but it's also a sign of how our world changes as we learn new things. And old Dogberry, he was bang on in loads and loads of things. He said at one stage, he said, indeed, the watch ought to offend no man. It is an offence to stay any man against his will. Absolutely bang on. Got a really good laugh every night that did, I think, for perceived naivety, but it is an offence to stay any man against his will, you know. No man has the right to impede the progress of another man unless he's seen to be causing harm, loss or damage. And Dogberry clearly understood that. Many other lines showed that he also understood and comprehended things that we know to be true. And he seems to share the idea with a lot of literary city watches and, in fact, you know, police forces around the place nowadays, that if you do manage to catch a thief or find a thief, you should let him show himself what he is and steal out of your company. I was told the other day that fraud is apparently a fraud in cyberspace and theft using computers and things like that. It's not actually a notifiable offence. That we did actually know somebody last year who had a series of frauds perpetrated against them, which one way or the other, despite the fact that, you know, computers were used, bank accounts were used, that kind of stuff. And it was even known who had the stuff, and I think where he was, but it was still apparently the local policemen were just not interested. They just didn't want to talk about it. Apparently it's too difficult to prove. And so, effectively, they did have a thief more or less in their hands. They knew he was, They'd even actually had him in the station on an unrelated matter, but he was still let go. They let the thief steal out of, show himself what he was and steal out of their company. And fraud and theft are basically, I mean, they're a cornerstone. They're actually possibly even the very foundation of our society. You know, what with loan notes and mortgages and interest rate manipulation. And that's not to mention all the appropriation of the gold and, in fact, pretty much anything of value. And, of course, registration, the handing over of rights of guardianship. All of this stuff is, in my opinion, a kind of theft. And all the way through Shakespeare, we find a kind of idea that these sort of behaviours are somehow forgivable. And they underpin the much grosser habits and stuff of the royalty who are just committing sort of more and bigger crimes, as it were. And despite the fact that the stuff is played everywhere, and some parts of it, I mean, the ones I've been talking about are treated as entirely fictional, there are some of these plays that are taken to be broadly historical, which is another curious point, because although people are kind of woven into the illusion on the stage and are happy to take the story for the kind of couple of hours or so, when it comes to the actual matter of the text, they sometimes appear to be paying very little attention at all. So we had a day when we did Henry IV part 1 and 2 and Henry V all in one day, and there was a bit of food in between. That's quite an extensive amount of work to do. And it's entirely a story of treachery and inconstancy and much betrayal and knobby behaviour. And it purports to be, these plays purport to be, and they're kind of generally accepted as part of the history that led us to be where we seem to be, shall we say. And there was kind of small uproar in the bar afterwards amongst folk who just watched the plays, and I asked them whether they were sort of generally happy with the way business appears to be conducted among these people, and, you know, the means by which our current apparent queen apparently got to be where she is and things. And there's a complete disassociation, even though these are actually accepted as kind of histories of what went on. There's somehow a kind of disassociation between that actual information going into them and what it is that we've got going on here, what it is that has such a huge and loyal fan base, you know, the royalty. And it does seem to me that quite often where Shakespeare is popular, royalty is popular as well. But somehow it's kind of neither one thing or the other. It's really interesting to see how people respond to this stuff. The play weaves them in, but the reality of it completely escapes them, which again just strikes me as being really like the life we're living at the moment. It is like being woven into something and the reality of it just escaping the vast majority of us, and escaped all of us, I suspect, for a fair while. I mean, I knew there were some people out there who seem to have been born understanding what it is that we're living in and what the name is and all of that. But most of us were in a stage of similar ignorance, I suspect, at some point. But it really is most surreal to be on an actual stage practicing these skills and looking at these lines and realizing that it is a tiny version of what I'm doing absolutely every day of my life. I do find that nowadays, or as we learn more about the actual facts of what's happening around us, that it becomes unnecessary to appear in so many different guises. I think when I was younger, it used to be a bit necessary, as it were, to be kind of one thing at home and one thing and another thing at school, say. I think that's probably a fairly clear example, because the whole approach that was kind of cool and acceptable at school would not necessarily have gone down too well at home. And in fact, in those years, loads of different roles were being played. I think as the seriousness of the current situation becomes apparent, our behaviour and our characters can become far more focused, where we are actually being us, where we are being a man and a woman that is genuinely interacting with the men and women around us, rather than falling into the illusion that has been so carefully woven for our entertainment and distraction. It's like helping us to become aware when we are being drawn into a role that's not us, and under those circumstances trying to stand firm wherever it is that we believe ourselves to be. I'm really grateful for these experiences. I think I'm really lucky to be able to do them. It's a it's a pretty hectic time of year, what with plenty of vegetables to be planted and everything coming to life and all of that. And it can be quite difficult to fit it in, but I regard it as just a hugely beneficial experience. And actually, it's reminded me how amazing the theatre is as well. Theatres can be a bit few, well, they are very few and far between now. But when I'm out in the field kind of doing talks and things on the casting of The Illusion and the rest of it, I often ask people whether they've ever seen any live theatre. And in these days of television and movies and all the rest of it, it's generally speaking less than 10%. And I think it is it's a really different experience. If folk out there haven't been to see a play, I thoroughly recommend finding a decent one to go and see, because it's all just a play. It is all just a puppet show. And it really is. It really is all just a stage. It's quite bizarre, really. I think I'm going to reach for another couple of tracks so that I can go and get myself a bit more water. And I'll be back with you very shortly. So we'll have The Clash and Know You're Right, shall we? Yeah, we will. Here we go. Truth Is from Cale Sampson there, and before that, Know You're Right from The Clash. Like the captain said, not often you'll find The Clash and Shakespeare on one show. I see that Jeff's put in the chat box, he's put, has John Dee been mentioned yet? No, I haven't mentioned John Dee. I've got sort of vague memories of reading a bit about that, but a long time ago. What's the connection between John Dee and the apparent Shakespeare then, Jeff? Looks like Midrin's mentioned it as well. Must have missed that. Sorry, Midrin. He's got a Welsh connection, that John Dee. He came over here on circuit. Was it circuit judges I used to send out from London? I used to send them out here. And there was a place called, there's a place up the road called Rioter, where they had the famous Rebecca riots, where all the men dressed up as women and refused to play tolls and things like that. And in those days, that's where the judge had to come to. He had to come into mid Wales, you know, a good 20, 30 miles beyond the skirmish zone, as it were. And John Dee was involved in a trip over here, apparently, where he was just travelling with the party. I don't think he was anything to do with the murder of the judge, but apparently the judge was killed. And as a result, we no longer have judges' lodgings and stuff that far into Wales. They're Cymru, they're much closer to the border now, over in a place called Prestine. Evidently felt safer over there, but I'll be interested. I'll have a look at the John Dee and Shakespeare link. I'm going to be playing out with a few tunes, but before I do that, I just want to remember we're going to be seeing The Factory at the Willow Theatre again this year. You can see Living Willow Theatre if you put that in all as one word into your favourite search engine. I'm sure it'll show you pictures and tell you what we've got on. But we will be having The Factory back. I always look forward to that. Because they did the most amazing thing I think I've ever seen. One or two of you will have heard this before, but they turned up and they decided that they were going to do a Russian play. I think he's Russian, is he? Austrian, whatever. Just Seagull, Chekhov, can't remember where Chekhov came from. Anyway, they decided they were going to do that, and because it's in one of those foreign languages, they had to use translations. So they looked at several translations, I think it was a dozen or so, and they realised that the translations were completely different from each other, really, to all intents and purposes. And given that, as I was pointing out earlier on, you can actually take, different people can take the same speech from Shakespeare and make something completely different of it from other people, that's even though they're reading the same words in the same language. Once you start translating these things, it becomes thank you very much. Unique Lee's put a summary of Baconian evidence for Shakespeare authorship. I shall go and have a look at that. What was I talking about? Oh, I was talking about The Factory. Yeah. And the translations obviously are really, really different because you're moving from one language to another and you can't really, transliterate. So what they decided to do was they decided they'd make it up every night. Absolutely brilliant. They're a small group of, I think, unemployed actors and actresses who kind of do the factory work to kind of fill time between one thing and another. But anyway, they're really good at what they do. And they decided they were going to invent their own version of the Seagull ex tempore, as it were, every night they did it. And it's a kind of 2.5 hour show. I'm not sure. I'm pretty certain there wasn't a break in the middle. And they did it using their own names. So they used their own monikers, as it were, what they were known as, instead of using like magistrate, magistrate's daughter or whatever was in the script. And they didn't have any props and they didn't have any costumes and they didn't have a stage. They didn't have any lighting. They didn't have any effects. No microphones, no amplification, nothing like that. It was just men and women making up a story as they went along, really. And they also played scissors, paper, string at the beginning of the whole thing. Scissors, paper, stone at the beginning of the whole thing to see in front of the audience to see who was going to play which parts. And I've never seen anything so compelling. I really haven't. I mean, these Russian plays, you have to have a good translation to make them work. But if they do, they're really angst-ridden, and quite often people end up shooting themselves at the end. And I found myself genuinely concerned for that. I know these people, you know. I've been working with them for a few years now. And I found myself genuinely concerned for the mental well-being. My inner me, as it were, my kind of, the endocrine system, all the, you know, the adrenaline and all that kind of stuff was pumping around me. And they genuinely managed to convince me to be really, really concerned about the mental health of at least a couple of the people that were on the stage. And they did that. They started doing that from the moment they started. Within 3 or 4 minutes of them starting to create this story in front of us, the audience were hooked. As I explained earlier, you can tell when it's happening, certainly from the stage and sometimes from the audience as well. What an amazing thing to be able to do, to be able to turn up any props you need, you grab off the audience, you don't have a script, you haven't done, well, you know, you've got a lot of experience with doing it, I guess, but absolutely fabulous. And they kind of, they'd been around for the area for 2 or 3 days doing a bit of workshopping and things like that. So they were able to work in a few local jokes to make it appear like it's all, you know, all been written round you rather than over in the, beyond the Iron Curtain as it then was. So really looking forward to seeing them. And, hopefully we'll be working with them as well, because every now and then one of the Willow Theatre Company, one or two or three of the Willow Theatre Company get involved in one of their unrehearsed ventures, and you, at that stage, have to be confident enough to join in and make of it what you can. And that is really great. Another thing I'm really looking forward to is the plays we do in the Willow Theatre. We're kind of at home. We rehearse there. We know it well. It has its own challenges, but we do these tours. We do sort of 2 or 3 date tour as well. When we go to really extraordinary places like our 17th century country houses, with these amazing gardens and houses that are all pegged together out of wood and things like this. And some of these places, I think, have actually been in the same hands since the 17th century. And we get to turn up, you know, on a Sunday lunchtime or whatever. Everything goes, all the costumes and whatever it was you need. We turn up, we've got our own live band that do all the sound effects and play all the music and all that kind of stuff. And we get to wander around the grounds, see where it is we're going to play the various scenes. Then we get given a high tea, and then we do the show. So it's all very, very different from where we used to. And again, that really makes the thing work well, because it's live for us. It's new for us. And that makes it kind of fresher for the audience. And then when it's all over, there's generally kind of beer and wine and eaten mess and cake and all that kind of stuff. Into the later part of the evening before we all disappear, and it's like it never really happened. That's absolutely great. It's just like the players are coming to town and things like that. And personally, I'd really like to do more of it. It'd be quite fun to get a few gaming tokens for it, wouldn't it? So I had a bit more time to concentrate on it and do it properly. But as it is, I still think that doing things voluntary and for the love of it probably works a lot better. So dead exciting for me. Don't know how exciting it's been for you lot, really, but unfortunately for you, I got the date wrong with my guest, so I had to come up with something for tonight, and this is what I've been doing. I think before I play out with a few tunes. Oh, evening, Jimmy. Nice to see you, matey. No problem being late. No problem being late. It's not late. What did I want to do? Oh, yeah. Oh, God, yeah. Before I finally leave the Shakespeare, and I probably won't inflict this on you again, folks, not unless I get something really spectacular turn up. But one of the favourite things I did, because it was just totally bloody outrageous, was we did some of these plays are very rarely put on frankly, and I can quite see why. People are far less keen to come and see the history plays and the political plays than they are to come and see things like Midsummer Night's Dream, As You Like It, and All's Well That Ends Well, and other such beats of puff. And some of them very, very rarely get done, and King John is one of those. And we did a kind of read-through, didn't have major part in that, really. In fact, I spent an awful lot of the time standing around on the stage with a flag. And there's a bit in the play, when we were first kind of running through it, there's a bit in the play where there's these two kings, I think there's a French prince, and there's King John from England, and there's some Austrian monarch as well. And they're basically pummeling the hell out of each other on some battlefield. And there's a town, I think it's Angers in France, where the locals have got themselves kind of boarded up. They've shut all the gates and they're standing on the wall and they're kind of watching the fighting. And this herald turns up from the King of England and he goes, basically, I'm the herald of the King of England and King John expects you to open your gates and let us in. And then this French geezer turns up with their flag and he says, well, actually, you know, you're subject to the French king and he expects you to open your doors and let us in. And the people, quite rightly standing on the walls, go, well, it's not entirely clear what's going on, is it? So we'll keep the gates shut until you two have finished pummeling the shit out of each other or whatever. And then we'll talk with, you know, whoever turns out to be the actual king by winning. And this so disgusts the various monarchs that they decide to turn their combined firepower onto the village, onto the town, and pummel that to dust before returning to fighting each other, which isn't how it works out. They sort it all out with a marriage, which is suggested by the people on the town wall. So they actually managed to sort it out. But I was just, oh, that's just disgusting, you know. Well, that's exactly the kind of thing these kings and queens get up to, and there it is, right in front of people, and it doesn't seem to bother them at all. Anyway, that's not the main point about King John. The main point about King John is that all of that hullabaloo is stirred up by a papal legate, i.e. a representative of the Pope to the court of King John. And he has a character called Cardinal Pandulf. And apparently Rome is whipping up all of this stuff. And because King John's given a bit of trouble, given them a bit of trouble on the choice of Pope, he's on the choice of Archbishop of Canterbury, that's right. He said, no, I'm not having the guy that Rome wants to put onto the sea. I want this other guy. And basically, all kind of mayhem is then whipped up by Rome until it's not possible for King John to resist everything. This is all part of the Magna Carta story. Of course, the signing of the Magna Carta and the handing away of the crown and all of that. And it was only when I'd read King John that I realised that that what had happened, and since been looked at a bit of history, and yeah, this is it. And it says in Act 5, this is one of my favourite bits of Shakespeare because of what it shows you. In Act 5, Scene 1, the beginning of the end normally for these plays, enter King John and Cardinal Pandulf and attendants, it says. And King John says, thus have I yielded up into your hand the circle of my glory. He says that to Cardinal Pandulf as he hands him the crown of England. And Cardinal Pandulf gives it back to him again and says, take from this my hand as holding of the Pope your sovereign greatness and authority. So that's the moment when England and its royalty became a vassal of Rome. And there it is. It's actually, you can find it in the histories. There's loads about it on YouTube. And there it is in the play. And I did that one in the bar as well. I said, so what about the fact that the king got handed over to the Pope and kind of like given back on sufferance? And again, watched the whole thing, drawn in by it, happy with the story and all that kind of stuff, but completely not prepared for some reason to actually consider this rather interesting but little known historical fact. And as I say, the more stuff you find out about history and about words and about legalese and stuff like that, the more stuff you find in Shakespeare, which is itself actually quite interesting. I'm pretty convinced that there's probably a lot more stuff than we expect in there. Is that one worth doing as well? Yes, there we go. Then Cardinal Pandulf says that his tongue, having done that bit of stuff with the crown, he says that his tongue is going to hush again the storm of war and make fair weather in our blustering land. On this ascension day, remember well, he says to King John, upon your oath of service to the Pope. Whoopee. really great. So, that's just, if you like, that's just a little, little bit of extra I get from doing the Shakespeare, is that you keep coming across all of these things. And I will have a look, little bit look more at the John Dee. And like I say, thanks to Lee for putting those links into the chat box too. Oh, I've lost myself now, putting the links in the chat box to a little bit more detail on that. Question of Macbeth, wasn't the three witches the King of Prague's three daughters? Anything is possible, Midrin. This is one of the things about my so-called education, which I really rather resent, is the fact that all of this, you know, historical things and musical things and literary things are all kept really, really separate from each other. So you never actually got to find out what was behind that. And I didn't really look into the political history of Shakespeare, even though, nominally speaking, I actually specialised in him. I didn't remember the first damn thing about it until I started doing it with these nice people that I'm working with at the moment. So I think it's just because it's three and you can't trust witches, can you? The King of Prague's three daughters. Do you know what? I bet there was loads of that stuff in Shakespeare that we really miss. I mean, you won't, the kind of all the little political in-jokes and things like that are one of the first things that get cut from our scripts. Anything that doesn't move it on, anything that is an obscure political joke, or not likely to be understood by a modern audience is removed. So there's about a third of each play goes missing before we start doing it, because otherwise, being amateur players and apparently a bit slow, the plays would take like 3.5 hours, and you'd need 2 bar breaks instead of just one, and it couldn't really be done. So there you go. It looks like it's about 11:15. Probably going to be out about on time tonight, because there's quite a lot going on that needs to be sorted out. Well, I'll play another couple of tunes and then come back to you before the end of the show. And what we got next? Ah, yes. Mass Destruction by Faithless, apparently. This is a cracking lyric, this one is. You are, of course, listening to Dr. Rock's radio show on raconteursnews.com. Thanks for being out there, folks. Here's some tunage. Seize the Day there, and Don't Do ID. And before that was Smiling Ivy and Efficient Waste of Time, another of those bands I caught at the Landed Festival a couple of years ago. So that's my fun sorted out on Saturday, off to listen to some bands and drink some beer, hopefully in the sunshine, rather than in this rather weird, bally Star Trek kind of snow that we've had falling recently. It's not the right stuff at all, you know. So bit of a fill-in show there. As I say, I was expecting something entirely else to happen early on this afternoon, and then it didn't. So next week we will be talking to Mick about returning to sender, not answering the door, and our side of occult power, as it were. So thanks very much to all of you for listening out there, Tar for being there, as it were. And I look forward to more next week. A little bit distracted at the moment, so I better play another tune. We're going to play out with AC/DC, Dirty Deeds, Done Dirt Treat, Cheap, from their very first album, I do believe. And I think the last tune will probably be Dr. Feelgood. Yeah, it will. Yes, it will. Okay, see you all next week. Tar for being there, folks. Bye.